Justice by any means necessary.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2023 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us for Socialism 2024, which will be held in Chicago next Labor Day weekend, August 30th through September 2nd. It's never too early to make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
Today, we are presenting ideas from the book Birth Strike, The Hidden Fight Over Women's Work. The book came out of theorizing and work from our feminist group, and the book's lead author is Jenny Brown. And now I'm going to turn this over to Stephanie.
So Brown starts the introduction with the thought, the effort to block birth control and abortion in the United States is not about religion. It's not about politicians pandering to a right-wing base. It's not about prudery or punishing women for having sex. It's about the labor of bearing and raising children. Who will do it and who will pay for it? We believe that women's oppression and the oppression of anyone who can become pregnant is largely due to many women's ability to become pregnant. We also believe that women's liberation and trans liberation are linked. We weren't born with our ideas. No one is. We develop and learn about our conditions and how to fight them by building the fight to do just that, and by organizing and by studying. Our group has come a long way from little to no analysis of trans liberation to a growing theory about why and how trans people and cisgender women are oppressed and the connection between these oppressions. Within the book, Birth Strike, we exclusively refer to women and not to trans people. We and the left in general have a ways more to go on learning and incorporating trans liberation into our analysis, and we're currently working on a position paper on this topic within NWL. Women and trans people, and those who do not fall within the gender binary, do not benefit from male supremacy. And we are all oppressed because of our reproductive capacity, whether that be perceived, possible, or not. The ruling class thrives on the exploitation of reproductive labor. Those of us relegated to the domestic sphere so that our labor can be extracted are more often expected to fill reproductive roles in society, whether that be through the individual reproduction of, you know, having and bearing children and raising them, or through generational reproduction in the form of elder care or, you know, caring for sick family members. We believe that women and those who are oppressed as women comprise a class. We demand lives without state interference and policing. We are punished by male supremacy, and so we fight together for liberation from male supremacy. Today, we want to raise consciousness on the concept of reproductive work as vital to all societies, unpaid, you know, which is unpaid reproductive and care labor. We want to discuss who benefits from the uneven distribution of care work. And then finally, how and why the government are obstructing our ability to control our reproduction through what we're currently seeing on bans on abortion, access to contraception, and of course how that's been linked, you know, with the attacks on trans healthcare and bodily autonomy. And finally, if you agree with most of this talk, we'd want to make sure that you feel comfortable in organizing others with these ideas. In the book Birth Strike, we argue that the ruling class has a financial interest in controlling the birth rate in the U.S., and they have even obsessed about how low it keeps dropping. The ruling class wants a supply of people as soldiers and workers. To be clear, we all need for continuing generations of workers to grow and develop. We need people to run society by working in hospitals, transportation, as farmers, etc., to, you know, ensure that society keeps functioning. But arguably, we, the 99%, don't need as many people as the ruling class or 1% may want. We need to take advantage of the ruling class's desire for more workers and the pressure the ruling class feels due to our declining birth rate, which is down to around 1.76, which is below replacement rate, and negotiate for better conditions for all of us. We need to go on the offensive. We need to fight for the right of everyone to decide when and if they want to have children, and to keep this power over the birth rate in our hands by organizing and growing the women's liberation movement. Because right now, we, those who produce labor and raise workers, are not fighting in a unified way. So I'm going to hand it over now to my comrade Brooke.
And then we will have a break for some questions, if there are any, just right after this segment. I wanted to give you all a just small historical think about how the U.S. has approached abortion, because I think a lot of times it can be a common idea that abortion has always been on the statute somewhere, right? But in fact, in the United States, in 1800, there were no laws on abortion. And so it's in the 1850s that we see the American Medical Association push for abortion laws. Based on what has been, you know, just written evidence from that time, it seems that they openly discussed their concern that the married birth rate is going down. And they were concerned that Catholics and immigrants were producing faster than Protestants. The AMA was also concerned on the growing respect and professionalization of doctresses and abortionists, because the AMA, of course, was made up of men at that time. And the widespread practice of abortion is why, or at least is credited with why, the U.S. birth rate dropped from 8 children per woman in 1800 to 4 in 1900, right? And so that's fairly life-changing. And then we see in the 1860s and 70s, many states, actually just this jump, and many states are punishing any pregnant person and practitioner who induce miscarriage. And in 1873, a lot of people here, I'm sure, already know, the federal Comstock Law was put into place, which outlawed not only abortion, but any information on contraception, right? All contraception, all information. It was a 5-year prison sentence. So I just said the words 1873, okay? There was pushback against it. There was organizing against it. But we see in 1905, President Roosevelt launched an attack on women for using birth control, stating it was race suicide. And we don't see information on contraception becoming legal in our country until 1936. We still have portions of Comstock around, right? Like, we get a lessening in 1965 when abortion is granted to married people. Typically, if in a cisgendered couple, the husband said yes. In 1973, the movement wins Roe v. Wade, right? Which, just to make sure we all know, is our then legal access to abortion. Okay. And there is a really rich history that I can't go into because of time constraints. But, you know, that wasn't gifted to us. We all appreciate here those wins came because of movement organizing. We have this history, but the at-large feminist movement has been really off on how we've talked about why there are abortion restrictions or contraceptive restrictions. And NWL puts out there that maybe some of it is because, you know, and so you hear this idea like it's a cultural issue, it's controlling women, but without the controlling for what means, right? This analysis might have come because the rebirth of feminism in the United States in the mid-1950s was coming when there is this brief 20-year episode when the ruling class is actually worried about overpopulation, right? So we win Roe right at the tail end when there is concern that this panic, right? That there's just too many people on the population bomb. So, and then also this period is burned into our minds because it was horrific. The ruling class, there were forced sterilization aimed at women receiving welfare and women of color, and in particular for African Americans, Mexican Americans, and Puerto Ricans, right? In Mississippi, the sterilization was called the Mississippi appendectomy because it was so common. And in Puerto Rico, it was La Operación, again, because it was so common, right? So with all of that brutalization, that then informed a lot of feminist organizers on what the ruling class wanted, you know, that they were actually mostly focused on keeping parenting from us. And so I have referred to the ruling class a few times, and I just wanted to note that while that class has common interests and common goals, there are conflicts within that class on to what degree those individuals are driven by white supremacy and homophobia. And so there are splinters, right? They're not unified. And I do suspect that the right wing's obsession with preventing trans youth and adults from accessing medical affirming care is linked to their fury that a working class individual could access medical care that might impact that person's fertility. So I'd like to turn it over to Allison. We are, I'm sorry.
Okay, so we'll do 5 to 10 minutes if folks have questions. If not, totally okay. Raise your hand. Call on folks.
Yeah.
Make sure you come back.
Yeah, anything.
And I've been on a team with Abortion Action Missouri. We've been doing deep canvassing. In Missouri, abortion is completely banned. So we've been talking with people, having extended conversations to say, you know, what do you feel about this ban? And we've been in wealthy areas of St. Louis. Some of the people have actually come out and said, I'm against the abortion ban because that means that there's fewer workers to, and I couldn't believe my ears. They said, because there's fewer people to do the jobs. And I couldn't believe it. I was getting a lot more responses around religious reasons, but I think that also goes to show that in the upper middle class, you know, there's a lot of indoctrination that comes around religion, but there's a lot underneath that is very insidious and makes me kind of shake when I think about it.
They do have that clarity, which is very interesting. So, yeah, thank you.
I haven't done so much like of my own research into this. I wanted to get more involved, but one thing I do think is often linked is like some of the anti-immigration and like also that how that works with like labor force and everything, and then anti-abortion, because people are like, we want more workers, but we don't want like those workers. Mm-hmm. So I think those are also, that's a big part of it too.
And we would like to talk more about that too. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
All right. I was just wondering, I was struck by the 1860s, 1870s, mm-hmm. and thinking about the control of who there is, and simultaneously with the end of slavery and then Reconstruction and then Jim Crow. So I'm wondering how, you said there's a longer history, but if there's a kind of part of that control of that history and the need to have more people to exploit the super exploitable.
Yeah, that's a great thought. I thought about that too. I mean, it's 1873, right? Officially, slavery is ending in 1865 in the midst of Reconstruction, where black people are getting some significant political power in the country, right? And also, the black labor force is not under the control, the same level of control, right, as it was, the major shift. So I think about that a lot, and I'll talk a little bit more, too, about just the importance of black labor, particularly in the South, but, you know, how that affects the whole country. And I think it's very connected. You know, the need in this, you know, the government, the corporations need for cheap labor, right? For labor that is easily exploited. That could look a lot of different ways, but certainly as it pertains to race and to the ending, you know, ending of formal slavery and then the iterations of slave-like conditions that follow. I think they're very related.
And in addition to all that as well, in the 1870s, the male population of the U.S. was decimated because they all died in the Civil War, and the military was concerned about refilling and replenishing their ranks with, like, at that point, I think we had the most single women in the country, we'd had adult women that we'd had in our history, so, because there were a lot of men that were not there anymore. Any more questions?
I was curious, and if we might get into this later, how this relates to like things like no-fault divorce also, you know, coming in to the legal books in various capacities.
And just to clarify, are you asking how the changes in abortion might be related to no-fault divorce? Or when you said this, what are you thinking of?
Yeah, the changes in legality of contraception and abortion.
I mean, I can certainly speak to, I don't know about divorce specifically, although that did seem to come out of the second wave feminist movement of the 60s and 70s. So again, this is the population bomb panic. But I can say, if you look at the history of contraception and after we lost all our contraceptive rights in the 1870s, almost always the laws were like, this woman can have birth control only if her husband approves it. And like everything had to go through the husband very much with contraception. As we were saying, at first abortion was only legal for married women, as if they're the only ones that need abortion, and usually at the consent of her husband only. So
I know just a bit from my training that, you know, divorce is a very state-by-state phenomenon. And so we actually have some states that didn't gain no-fault divorce until like the last 15 years. So it's been slow coming, right? And I think that the ability to divorce, and then also if you have a marriage in which there are children of that marriage, what happens to those children, right? Because we also had divorce, but where a woman would lose her children, right? And so there's a lot of issues there. I am not aware of the link to contraception and divorce and those rights as much as I think under the broader framework of how strong is our feminist movement at that time, right? I think that might be the bigger push. And then I just wanted to bring up the point, you know, that we're seeing now in terms of this backlash, you know, against, you know, like abortion rights, you know, bodily autonomy. You know, we're also seeing attacks on contraception, and of course a lot of these politicians are now saying they want to get rid of no-fault divorce.
I remember the generation that won Roe versus Wade. I was 18 years old when it went through, and I'm also a part of the generation that lost it. And I participated in years in clinic defense and, you know, supporting Planned Parenthood. And my feeling for years has been we were extremely legalistic. We were always telling people they have to rely on the courts, rely on the politicians. And I really hope the one thing that the younger generations take from this is that we were so damn wrong. I mean, the only reason we hung on to it as long as we did was the little bit of individual action that our mobilization and our collective action that we took to try and defend it.
Yeah.
Here. Maybe that's a good jump here. Here, absolutely. As we see in our mission statement, we don't think that the changes that we have were made by the media or the courts. They're made by everyday people taking actions together in powerful movements that we're continuing to build. So, one fundamental area we wanted to delve into is, does this theory and do these conditions apply to Black women and Black babies, the Latinx community, people of color in general, and if so, how? So in my own experience, in the experience of the Women of Color Caucus of our group, some of us have had fewer babies than we've wanted because conditions are so bad. Not being able to afford to raise another child, having less support from a spouse or a partner than we expected that we would have, having difficulty finding a partner to parent with, And we also know that systems like foster care, child welfare, the criminal injustice system, and others target and tear apart Black and brown families, making our conditions for raising and bearing children even more complex and difficult. So we're definitely affected. Now, the idea that the 1% wants more Black children, for instance, does, at first glance, seem to conflict with what we see in this white supremacist system. As the book highlights, there is a long-held theory by several Black organizers that the U.S. government continues to commit genocide against Blacks in the U.S. So Black nationalism is a theory, another unifying theory that, like the birth rate theory, drew it all together for me with shocking clarity. It's a theory that says that white supremacy is not about, and racism is not just about whites treating Blacks badly, from police abuse to poverty, incarceration, to voter suppression, and all of these disparate outcomes that we're always talking about, but it's really about control of a nation of people. So what do I mean by a nation? I mean a people with shared ancestry and shared historical circumstances. Loretta Ross has said, it's about control of populations for a material gain. So that makes sense to me. One nation, or really one government, controlling another set of people, another nation, is what we understand the U.S. and powers all over the world. Colonialism in one form or another, whether colonizing people on their own land or controlling the people economically, even if they have their own land and their own rulers on paper, or sort of neo-colonialism, or controlling a people by stealing them from their land and controlling their economy in a new land. So thinking of Black people as a colonized nation right here in the U.S. makes sense to me. The theory of Black nationalism explained both our conditions and a theory for our liberation. And if we can understand Black people here as a nation, then it makes sense to look at our conditions and understand them as genocide. As these Black organizers charged before the UN in their 1951 petition called We Charge Genocide. The writers of the petition included left leaders W.E.B. Du Bois, Claudia Jones, Harry Haywood, Paul Robeson, and families of lynched Black people. They explained that the genocide was more about control than about complete annihilation or physical annihilation of a people. So more about control. Quote, they said, "The foundation of this genocide, of which we complain, is economic. It is genocide for profit. The intricate superstructure of, quote, law and order and extra legal terror enforces an oppression that guarantees profit," end quote. So the cops and other enforcers of this system shoot us in the streets. They keep us dying from poverty and crappy health care, and the list goes on. But what for? Why? Shooting unarmed Black people keeps us all scared and keeps most of us in line. Keeping us in jail means we're working for nothing, legalized slavery, producing profits for the very few, and whatever their personal racist attitudes may be, the 1% benefits richly off of our underclass status. So as we see, the 1% may very well want more Black and brown babies, even as the conditions of our oppression shorten our lifespans. One more example that stands out to me is that Black work matters, and we were talking about that just a moment ago. So the value of our work as some of the most exploited workers, and what lengths the government and corporations have gone to keep Black labor in place historically and now, is something that I hope we'll have the time to return to a little bit later.
Great, thank you, Allison. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about international comparisons. When we compared our situation internationally, particularly to Europe, where the birth rate in many countries is as low as or lower than in the United States, we found that there, much like here, the birth rate is openly discussed as a problem by politicians and in the media. We've seen that when those in power have two options to raise the birth rate, one of the options they have is to put resources towards making it easier to have and raise children through policies such as universal childcare, universal healthcare, paid parental leave, affordable housing, livable wages, and decent working hours. Or they can enact laws which strip away access to abortion and birth control to take away our ability to say no. We've seen this in places like Turkey and Poland. You know, abortion is completely outlawed in Poland, and in Turkey it's theoretically available up to 10 weeks, but only in theory, not in practice. So there, leaders are attacking reproductive rights with the open goal of raising the birth rate. In other countries, such as France and Sweden, for example, where politicians have been more responsive to the feminist movements there, governments are promoting policies that support parenting, like the ones I mentioned before, like universal programs. And these countries have experienced higher birth rates as a result. And then there are other countries, such as Russia, which are doing a mix of both. They are increasing paternity leave, they're increasing payments to families for having children, but at the same time, they are restricting access to abortion and birth control. In all cases, the reasons for these policies are in the open. How can we get people to make more babies? That question has led some to an answer which is echoes what feminists have been long saying: equality at work. You know, women's equality within the labor market. Stefan Kronert, a Berlin demographer, explained, "For a long time, politicians said that the high participation of women in the labor market is responsible for the low birth rate, because when women go into the labor market, they don't have children anymore. But interestingly, when you look at these Western European countries, the fertility rate is higher in countries with a higher labor market participation of women. And this can be partially explained by the fact that these countries have a strong social safety net that allows women and families to maintain their jobs, maintain job security throughout pregnancy, and then have universal child care and elder care so they're not stuck doing the unpaid double and triple day like we're doing here in the U.S. So that's our comparison to European countries specifically. And then here in the United States, what we're seeing is this push from neoconservatives and the right wing, although from what it's worth, it's not like the Democratic Party is much better on this either, to put the burden of the cost of raising and bearing children directly on people and families. So much like in Europe, U.S. politicians and establishment think tanks have been openly fretting about the lowered birth rate. They worry about flagging consumer demand, immigration and its attendant political problems, an aging workforce, which is causing a rise in entitlement spending, such as Social Security and Medicare, and also how to keep the U.S. military strong when both the working age tax base and the supply of young people to enlist is shrinking. But while, as we talked about, other countries' governments have sought to make childbearing and rearing easier through government and employer-funded policies and programs, here we are seeing this conservative push to keep the cost of birth and care work on families. Right-wing politicians portray themselves as pro-family, and you've probably recently heard them use the phrase culture of life to describe their policies. But they continue to slash funding for programs that would actually help children and families. They block efforts to increase the minimum wage. They make cuts to early childhood care and school lunch programs. They're cutting funding for welfare payments to families, and they're cutting funding for healthcare programs for children. And they oppose any kind of family leave, paid or otherwise. Why would they be doing these things if they are supposedly pro-family? What they really want is families instead of government. They want to cut government spending and put the work on families. And by families, they mean women as a class and women's unpaid labor. One method the employing class uses to push this small government and big families program, as we call it, is to exploit the U.S. ethos of hyper-individualism that promotes having children as an individual economic choice at best or an extravagant personal indulgence at worst. Often, having children is seen as a lifestyle choice instead of what it really is, as Jenny Brown states in her book, Birth Strike, a needed job that parents take on at great personal expense, in which the larger community, because it benefits, should support and assist. If children are seen as a personal indulgence, then it's very easy for policymakers to cut funding to programs which support the work of raising them. And once these programs are too expensive to access, then families, and most often women, have to step in and make do as best as they can. But this burden of cost and care work has made people think twice about having children, as we're obviously seeing now, thus the falling birth rate. Some conservatives believe that an incentive is needed to encourage people to have children, but they favor cash incentives or tax credits, which as we know are effectively nothing or just disappear, over universal programs, which do very little when the estimated average cost to raise a child is $1 million or more dollars. Others believe that the way to increase the birth rate is to crack down on abortion and birth control, thereby increasing the population through coercion and forced birth. This squeeze also enforces the traditional family structure that conservatives claim to value so deeply. It's not actually about religion or a moral high ground, although religion is a very convenient way to fire up their base. But what they really want is to coerce people into the cheapest, most efficient baby-making unit, which to them is the heterosexual married with children model, you know, heterosexual two kids picket fence. This explains the underlying motive for anti-LGBTQ plus policies and discrimination. And it might explain the big money behind the appalling anti-trans bathroom bills and other attacks on anyone who deviates from the heterosexual marriage and lots of kids model. So now we're going to open it up to another 5 to 10 minutes of questions or comments about the two sections that we just presented on. So if anyone has any questions, comments, just raise your hand, and then my comrade Molly will call on you.
Can I throw out one thing? I just wanted to throw out, I don't think that this was implied at all in what Stephanie just said, but we are not promising to make children if we get the universal programs that we're demanding, okay? We're not like, what we're saying is that if my comrade wants to have a child, then they should be supported and compensated and appreciated for that work, right? Like, that's what we're saying. And so just to make that clear, it's not like a trade. So,
thank you, Brooke.
Questions? I'm also from Puerto Rico, where 66% of women were forcibly sterilized at one point, and the birth control, the oral pill that we enjoy today was, you know, because they tested on Puerto Rican women. But I kind of wanted to like point back to what the comrade said about like not relying on politicians. And I think like if we know that they control reproduction for profit, and if we know that neither the Republicans or the Democrats are going to defend our rights, I think it'll be ideal if we could get, you know, all of the working class solidarity, and even if we dare to think about a working class party that fight for socialism here in the U.S. So I think that's one of the ways that I kind of see forward.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Hello, thank you all. And my question is really more of an invitation. I don't think that you'll have a like policy proposal at the end of this, but I'm really kind of compelled by the idea of leveraging the birth strike as some sort of response to this anxiety about a declining population. and also compelled by this international lens where we have such uneven policies and clearly a globalized world where people are crossing borders, coming with their children, have different kinds of birth rates. And I'm wondering how we do both of those things while kind of holding the lessons of that kind of racist population bomb thinking, and how as feminists, as organizers, where there is no kind of universal globalized scheme that happens at once, where there's one policy, we kind of move through that. And certainly, I think many of you are New York-based. The kind of rhetoric around the migrant crisis or people moving into the city so shapes my thinking about that. That feels like such an obviously like surplus population that can be taken advantage of in this moment. So yeah, that's kind of just a provocation, a question.
Well, so we're on our next section, it's actually immigration and birth rates.
I am, although it doesn't speak directly, I just wanted to throw out there, because this isn't entirely to your comment. In our group, we have struggled, we toyed with the, I shouldn't say toy, it sounds very simple, but we were thinking of putting out a call for a birth strike. We decided not to. We decided not to after, I mean, sessions at, oh, might make me cry now, like, where we talked about wanting to be parents or trying to be parents or putting it off or how hard it is to have a child. And for me, it took a couple years to get pregnant. So if I, as committed, I'm committed, but once I got pregnant and I really wanted to be pregnant, I didn't want to go on a birth strike. You know, like I didn't want to tell a group, yeah, I'll just try again in a year. I really wanted that child, right? And it's so hard individually to get the finances together, to get your job right, you know what I mean? To line all the things up. And so we just really didn't think that it was right as a political campaign, at least when we were discussing it in like 2016 or so. It was like, it's just, it's too much. It's too much to ask of people, you know? And so it's more to ask proactively for the things that we need so that it would be much easier to be able to, you know, decide to become a parent or not. So.
I think, just to add, in conjunction with that, what the, you know, with the title of the book, Birth Strike, was really more descriptive, saying there is a bit of a birth strike going on, right? You look at a graph and the line is going down and down and down. It's below replacement rate. And people are actually responding to our conditions. And we, there is a birth slowdown. You know, we are a little bit on a soft strike.
It's not an organized strike.
So we do want, and so part of what we want to talk about is how, you know, how do we harness that energy that we, you know, are taking advantage of in some ways, but not as an organized and as an organized way as we would want. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh,
I think they're both blue
shirt.
I'm an economics professor, and I try to get this kind of stuff into economic spaces. And listening to this, it would be so awesome if you're able to put together a pedagogical thing that economists who don't actually know what they're doing and think they do could adopt. I'm constantly just trying to sneak things in. So there's just so much of this that is clearly, they'll be like, no, that's not abortion. It's not an economic thing. No, like it is, and you make it so clear. And there are a lot of well-meaning, completely misguided, clueless economists out there who would possibly be able to put this into an intro course, which would do so many things to try to make it clear what's going on here with labor. And if you're interested, reach out, because I have a way of distributing that to like all the economists.
Well, and we should talk, but we also, for anybody here, our website is womensliberation.org. So if you reach us at nwl@womensliberation.org, we would love to continue a conversation with anyone here.
And I just wanted to make a note actually related to our website. If you go to our website, on the front page actually, is a film made by one of our comrades. Her name is Christine Monkhouse, and she made a documentary, a short documentary. It's about 10, 15 minutes long about the economic cost of abortion bans, which is fantastic, and I think will speak to some of what you're saying, you know, explaining how, you know, they're related and, you know, with solid data and backed up, you know, so economists hopefully can see, you know, this is a real thing.
Yeah, I think that they would see that, but I think colleagues, mm-hmm. they don't. Yeah, they don't. So it would be helpful to think really like, for idiots kind of explanation of what is being said mm-hmm. in the documentary, because like they will listen to it and be like, oh no, I'm in favor of things, and I think they will.
Yeah, no, that's a fantastic idea. Thank you.
Should long sleeves?
Carol.
I try to teach the economics of it in my classes too on the prep. But if you look at the cover of the book, Unpaid Labor, and there's pregnant Brooke, that's you me. Know? Nothing could make the economics of it more clear. It's reproductive labor, unpaid labor. It's like the other group of people in our country who didn't get paid for their work, right?
Oh, it's clear to us, but it is so not clear to us.
I know.
They will just not see this, and if they take 5 minutes.
I remember the huge poster, unpaid labor.
Yes, this is that.
Hey, thank you guys for being here. I have kind of a statement and kind of a question. So my little sister is 14 years old and has been gawking about wanting to be a mom and wanting to have babies. And I'm seeing so many ads between games on TV about, I guess my question is, how do you think the money is going into ads to impact people at a very young age to get them ready to want to be this, to want to have babies, to want to, I just have seen an interesting increase in the way my sister talks about different things. And I'm like, where did you get that from? Interesting. And it's just interesting. And I want to see how much they are targeting younger people not to get to a point where we're like, oh, we don't have any help. Like, but to start out with, oh no, this is definitely something I want. Quote unquote, the American dream. I think that's most of what I have to say.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating. You know, I think there are real indicators. It's a little bit when you start thinking about them, you start seeing them more. So, it's a little bit anecdotal, but I mean, I remember seeing magazines in the stores talking about like celebrities like a baby bump and like all this kind of hype around like having babies and I don't know, was that a thing in the 50s, 60s, 70s, or the 80s? I don't know, I wasn't there or paying attention to it. But something you see, there's like TV shows about teen moms and like the good, bad, the ugly, but there's a show, there's somebody relatable on TV having kids, again, the good, bad, or the ugly, whatever you may think, may think of it. I definitely see those. And it also makes me think of this fantastic article by Lita Hollingworth, which was written at the turn of the previous century, around 1900. The title is something like Social Devices for Impelling Women to Bear Children, and just talks about all the sort of candied ways that maternity is described. There's, in general society, there's no discussion of childbirth, pain, death, the risks, the financial, et cetera. But it's all sort of like lovely and instinctual and like this kind of like the instinct idea is really pushed. And this is, in the 1900s, she's writing this. So I think it's out there.
I think that's what's happening right now. It's so lovely, it's so great. And yet, there's nobody here telling you, actually, there's no support, there's no help, and it's awful.
Well, it is kind of funny. I'm so sorry. Like, I do all the mom blogs. They're pretty good. And some of them, And so there is this growing, like, very feminist voice of, yes, it doesn't mean I don't love my kid if I'm going to kvetch about how hard this is. Like, and so it pulls a lot on patriarchy that might be within a particular relationship on asking more from partners. And I haven't seen as much of it asking from the state. But there is, to me, in my little bubble, like this growing awareness just that this is labor and this is very difficult. And I do see more and more people naming that they cannot have another child. Because I believe that married people are some of the highest
users of abortion, because then it's real.
I believe 70% of abortions are had by someone that's already had one child.
Had one, okay, that would be more, okay. So yeah, so I mean, like, the moms are, you know, the parents are ready to have an abortion. So, yeah, but, and I know
there are first questions, but we're also getting a bit close.
Yeah, and I had signaled to the person in the black shirt, too, that she could also, and so, yeah, so just, like, maybe these two people, and then we'll be...
And I look at anti-abortion movements, anti-LGBT movements, particularly in Mexico, and I just wanted to share in response that many of these sort of in the cultural sphere, these pushes towards encouraging young girls and women to have babies and think of themselves early on as mothers is really insidious and difficult to see. But I wanted to share one example from I've observed in my research in Mexico. Anti-abortion, very, very wealthy donors have backed this whole initiative called Destroyer in Mexico, and it's all over. And they even have these dedicated stores where they cater to young girls and they sell fetuses that you can raise. It's like hatching an egg or something. Like, you get this fetus and you raise it, and you have to, like,
it's like a toy.
It's like a toy. It's a toy. It's a toy. And everything is, like, pink, and it's like this huge celebration of motherhood, and it's all over. And it's like, you go to the regular supermarket and you want to buy your child, actually she has like a, you know, thing for painting, like a, one of the little, and it's like got the Destroyer, like the imagery is just all over. So then it becomes really insidious, but where it's actually rooted in these very explicit attempts to do exactly what you're saying. So just, you know, we see the insidious manifestations, but it's just good to know that there, that is a very deliberate strategy that we can point to. So I just wanted to share that.
Yes.
It like grows into a baby.
It's easier to trigger the reward and risk system in your brain when you're younger than it is to bring you off the fear when you get older.
Totally agree. Yeah. And I just wanted to throw out there two things. One is, as far as movements or actions, I'm supporting the National Mobilization for Reproductive Justice, and one of the things we're doing is trying to get the AFL-CIO to launch an emergency conference so that, you know, working people can really have a say in having a national impact. But the other thing, so you can see me if you want to sign that, or my other sister here. The other thing is, I want to put forth that the talk about controlling a nation and it being defined as common ancestry and history, I would put forth that's a short definition, and I'm not sure, well, I'm just not that sure. I don't agree that black folks are an oppressed nation. I think they're an oppressed race. And so my question is, how does the author include or apply that definition to other races, which in the U.S. have been negatively impacted by, you know, whether sterilization or uninformed or not chosen forms of control. So I'm curious about how that impacts others, or if she says anything about it.
So I would say, so I am bringing the analysis of nationalist theory into this analysis. We do talk about, or, you know, the author group talks about race and reproduction, immigration and reproduction in the book, not specifically or not much specifically on nationalism per se, but I agree, it was a short reference, but I think how I can connect. So one of the ways, and one thing we do in our group is we try to speak about our learning curve, so like how we've learned something can sometimes make it a better explanation than the sort of the postscript. So what I would say is, in this country, and particularly in this country, the way I learned it was that you have nation, state, and government, right? And then you have land, country, and people. And you try to match them. It's better with visuals, but you try to match them. And we use the term nation and country sort of interchangeably, generally speaking, in the U.S., right? But when you look at the history, and it's in some ways it's not really hidden, right? When you look at the history of the U.S., like we learned some of these things in school. The Louisiana Purchase. How was Alaska acquired? The areas of the country that are more clearly colonies, like Puerto Rico, Guam, et cetera. And so it does bring this question of if the U.S., if a government acquires other lands, do they also acquire the people that are on those lands? What is that called, right? When a government acquires other peoples and other lands and then controls those peoples and those lands, like what would that be called? Globalism? What?
Colonialism.
Colonialism, yes.
Prison House of Nations.
Prison House of Nations. And what would that entity be that controls those other nations? Is that a nation? Is it a country? It's an empire, right? So, you know, other empires throughout history have been called empires at times, right? Holy Roman Empire, et cetera. The U.S. is not typically or often referred to as an empire, but if you look at the history, again, not totally hidden, right? Colonialism around the world, colonizing of black people, colonizing of indigenous people, and then Alaska, Hawaii, you know, the whole middle section of the country, Mexico parts, you know, I mean the entire country, right? That's the history of the entire country. So I would say there are many colonized peoples, I would say, in the U.S. who are, you know, have been or are fighting for independence. Native American populations, Chicana populations, Puerto Rican independence movement. And so, you know, not all peoples are as united or in land mass or in language as others. And, you know, and you see that around the world too, right? There are different sections that are fighting for or intention about how they want to exercise power. Scotland, the Basque people in Spain, Ireland to some extent, right? There's many other examples of people who are colonized and who are trying to be able to leverage power as a group, whether that's called nationhood or secession or federation or however they're trying to exercise that power. So I'd be happy to talk more afterwards about how, you know, how that might look for different populations.
We're actually going to finish the last, because we've got half an hour left of the whole thing, so I'm going to turn it over to Brooke to finish the last two sections, and we'll end for discussion. Brooke and Stephanie.
Okay, yes. And so we did want to go a little bit into immigration. And so Simone brought up, you know, just this issue of that it is a solution for the ruling class, right? And we've seen that the United States has turned to immigration as a solution throughout our history. We've seen that in the 1870s, and then at the beginning of the 20th century, that we have immigration and the birth rate being discussed in the same racist breath, right? And so if Native women don't have more children, then the U.S. will be overrun with immigrants, right? And so previously in the 1800s, there were fears of Slavs and Jews and Catholics and the Chinese, and now there are fears being promoted of Latinos and Muslims. And it's this, insults haven't changed very much, and so the insults are they're disloyal, they'll bring foreign ideas and religions, there's going to be class conflict and crime and drugs, and they won't assimilate, and they'll outnumber real Americans, right? Like, so just they haven't gotten very creative. And again, there is a divide, right, in the ruling class, but we see some pro-immigration Republicans who are very candid that they favor immigration to compensate for the low U.S. birth rate. There was the late Ben Wattenberg of the pro-corporate American Enterprise Institute. He wrote, quote, "A baby born 9 months from now won't even start paying into life Ponzi scheme for a generation. And that happens only after we spend a lot of money to raise and educate the child. A quicker fix would be instant adults. As it happens, they are available. Immigrants." Right? And so he does let out a truth
about immigration that's often hidden, and that is that immigration is a huge ripoff of our country taking the labor and the resources of the parents and the communities and the countries that those individuals leave behind. And of course, we hear the opposite, right? But while so we have a certain segment, we have the right wing encouraging anti-immigrant bigotry in public, but their policies on the workforce are often quite different. And so we see the Koch brothers, who are some of the largest donors to conservative political causes. They've been pushing Congress to allow people who are brought to the United States as children to be able to stay. Trump, when he was building a wall and sending troops to the border to block people from fleeing violence in Central America, said he still supported adding 30,000 slots to the H-2B guest worker program. They do want to strip, the ruling class wants to strip many immigrants of workers' rights and protections. And so they do typically favor a guest worker program where there's in order to keep your lawful status within the country, you must maintain employment with certain employers, right? And this gives the employer complete control. Because if an employee is going to complain about sexual harassment or try and organize, they can be fired and deported. And because they're deported, then you don't have to create unemployment insurance either. So it's like this complete win for the ruling class. And this might seem like the perfect solution, but there are a couple of issues. And so first is that immigrant workers, with documentation or without, have led or contributed to many of the significant labor struggles of the last 30 years. And so there are a few examples are the meatpackers in New York City, North Carolina, taxi drivers in New York City, janitors in LA, port truck drivers in Long Beach, farm workers in Florida, and domestic workers all over the country, right? And so this trend of many immigrant workers have a higher class consciousness could be due to their country of origin, right? Where they're just other places in the world have much higher class consciousness than the United States. So another problem for the ruling class is that when immigrants are able to vote, they usually vote for progressive causes and for progressive candidates. And then finally, conservatives have recognized that a flaw with immigration is there's not an unlimited number of people, right? And so there's a pundit, he's like a Wall Street Journal contributor, Jonathan Last, and he wrote, "Relying on immigration to prop up our fertility rate presents several problems, the most important of which, it's unlikely to last." So, Allison.
All right, so we have a little bit of conclusions and demands. I'll start. So in our group, as we've talked about, the falling birth rate made perfect sense to us. Many of us, when we started looking into this, were in our 30s, and we could clearly see how the difficult conditions convinced us to have fewer children. We held a consciousness-raising meeting in 2015, where we discovered that many of us stopped at one child because it was just too difficult. The costs, the exhaustion, the double day of working 8 or more hours paid, and then coming home and doing 8 or more hours of care work and housework. There are people like us all over the country who are blaming themselves when they want kids, but don't see how they can make it work. They're thinking, oh, if I'd gone into a better paying profession, or if I could find a job with real paid leave, if I were brave enough to quit my job and move back where my parents live, if I could just find the right childcare arrangement, if only I'd found a spouse who worked fewer hours or did more of their share, or the perfect cheap apartment, if I hadn't gone into so much debt for school. In other words, we see it as something we individually did wrong rather than understanding this as a system that relies on our unpaid work to function. Consciousness raising, or CR, is a tool that the women's liberation movement adapted from the civil rights movement in the late 1960s. where the civil rights movement spoke about telling it like it is. In CR, people answer a question using examples from their personal lives, then the group uses these personal testimonies to draw conclusions about the political root of the so-called personal problems. CR is where we first developed the idea for Birth Strike.
All right, so for our conclusion, the battle over abortion and birth control is not simply a cultural conflict where two sides hold different worldviews. If our focus is that narrow, then we can't see why corporate owners and establishment planners would have much interest one way or another. But if we look at the battle as a fight over the production of humans, how many, how fast, at what cost, then it seems likely that employers, as a class, would have an intense interest. They would especially care when they are expected to put in resources, as they are whenever we demand paid family leave or childcare. Increasing the birth rate serves an economic goal. An ever-expanding workforce raised with minimal public spending and maximum unpaid work. Why would employers pay for parental leave if they can get away with not providing it? Why would corporations pay taxes for national childcare if families can be convinced to take on that burden? But women and all parents are refusing, and our lowest ever birth rate demonstrates that. And that gives us some leverage. As the birth rate goes down, the value of our unpaid labor raising successive generations can be seen more clearly by everyone. So we think it's time to bring the battle out into the open and raise some demands. We demand reproductive freedom, full access, and no coercion. To have or not to have, we need all the tools to consent to parenthood or not. Those who identify as men and all who benefit from male supremacy, and those who benefit from white supremacy, we need you to take on a fair share of care work, housework, and emotional labor. Acknowledge how racism and sexism influence labor allocation and compensation, or not, rather than actual skill or importance. We demand universal health care with expanded and improved Medicare for all, no private insurance companies. Universal paid parental leave, at least 6 months, like 50 other countries have, and not tied to our employer. Universal childcare, free like the public schools. Protection and expansion of Social Security. We should all be able to retire. A shorter work week with a living wage. And that is the conclusion of our talk. And so now what we're going to do is we're going to...
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.